Hi, this is Melody. Welcome to Crazy Town. In this bonus episode, Rob interviews Peter Kalmus, a close friend of Post Carbon Institute and a leading climate scientist and activist. This is Peter's second visit to Crazy Town, and the focus this time is on civil disobedience and the ups and downs of getting arrested. I hope you're enjoying our bonus episodes. If you are, please let your friends and family know about Crazy Town by giving us a 5-star rating and hitting that share button on your app. Now, for the conversation between Rob and Peter.
Peter Kalmus is a climate scientist at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory. He has a PhD in physics from Columbia University and a BA in physics from Harvard. At work, he studies biodiversity and ecosystem projection using models and satellite data. At home, he explores how reducing carbon emissions can lead to a happier, more connected life. Peter is the author of the book, Being the Change, Live Well and Spark a Climate Revolution, and Peter has been a guest here in Crazy Town. So, Peter, it's great to have you. Welcome back to Crazy Town.
Yeah, thanks for having me back again. I definitely feel like I've never left Crazy Town.
I also got to give the quick disclaimer that you are speaking on your behalf, not on NASA's behalf, which is good because you have lots of interesting perspectives to share.
Yeah, and I love NASA so much, and I love working for NASA, so I do try to abide by their guidelines on stuff like that.
Yeah, well, okay, so the last time that you were here on the podcast, Peter, we talked about some unbelievable weather anomalies, we talked about your book, Being the Change, and I wanted to have you back to talk about civil disobedience. And let me give our listeners the basics of what transpired, and then we'll get some details from you. In April of this year, 2022, you and some colleagues locked yourselves to the entrance of the J.P. Morgan Chase building in Los Angeles, California. And the point was to protest J.P. Morgan Chase because it funds more new fossil fuel projects than any other investment bank.
It funds more new fossil fuel infrastructure than any other entity on the planet.
Okay. So we can vilify them even more.
It's just fact.
Well, and of course, this is your huge concern is climate. And of course, the result is that you were arrested. So I'm wondering if you can describe what pushed you into that corner? Why did you decide to take that action of civil disobedience?
Yeah, Rob, I've been a climate activist for 16 years. I've been a climate scientist for 13 years now. It's amazing how quickly the time flies. But I've tried so many different things over the course of those many years to get society to move on climate and the inaction of society, the way society has ignored climate for such a long time. And now it's starting to talk about climate stuff, but it hasn't really made any, in my opinion, any real motions towards addressing the problems. And it's world leaders are still kowtowing to the fossil fuel industry and the financial sector and building new fossil fuel projects, even though we now have cheaper alternatives. I mean, it's just madness. And as a climate scientist who realizes that this is not by any means the new normal, that we are on basically an escalator to hell and hotter temperatures, to continue seeing this in action and to be the father of two sons just absolutely kills me. And every year, as these climate disasters get worse and become more frequent, I become more desperate and more aghast at the inaction from world leaders and corporate leaders and society at large. And I feel like, you know, writing books is great. And writing my book really helped me just kind of figure out how to frame things and what I wanted to say, and even brought me further into the ways of thinking about this stuff, right? For me, writing the book was kind of a way to think. But it's not enough. It's not creating enough change. It's not having enough social impact. Writing articles hasn't had enough social impact. Founding phone apps and even ad agencies for the earth, nonprofit ad agencies, it hasn't had nearly enough impact on moving society into what I call emergency mode. So I felt like it was way past time to try civil disobedience. It was a kind of experiment and it worked great. I think what it did was it cut through this collective bystander effect that we have, this sort of collective denial, all of this noise, all of this doubt, all of this distraction, it managed to cut right through that for people and go straight into their brain and sort of say like, hey, this really is an emergency. And that was exactly what I hoped would happen.
Yeah, I'm wondering if you could describe how it felt to you taking the risk, you know, putting your body on the line, getting chained up, and then getting arrested, especially if any of our listeners are interested in their own acts of civil disobedience. What's that process like, and how does it feel?
It was simultaneously scary as fuck, and also just like completely opening and wonderful. So I felt just clearly being on the right side of history, finally joining all of the brothers and sisters around the world who have been for a long time engaging in these sorts of actions. And whereas I've been on the sidelines respecting them and wondering when the hell I would do something like that. It was a full body, full mind, full spirit experience. And I still think it was one of the best things I've ever done in my life.
Wow. Yeah, I have not participated in an act like that myself. I've had a little training, and I recently interviewed Taylor Broerby, who was arrested for protesting the Dakota Access Pipeline. And we've had Tim DeChristopher on, who kind of had a famous civil disobedience act for disrupting an auction to sell off oil rights in federal lands. And I just have huge, huge respect for you and the people that are willing to do that. I think it's an act of courage, but it's also good to hear you say that it almost sounds like it was a relief, you know, to join in and sort of become, I guess, more congruent with your values.
Exactly. So I just thought of a way of describing it. So, you know, I shackled myself to this door, and then the police came and they shackled my hands behind my back. And then I was shackled to various hard surfaces in the police station. You know, they have this metal bench and they have ways of moving your handcuffs from behind your back to various other places. So I was shackled for a while, but I'd kind of thrown off much more important shackles, which were my own sense of limitation, of like holding back. And like you said, not being completely congruent with my values. But that fear and going against those social norms, it's a very hard thing to do. And if anything, I just have even greater respect, which is hard because I was already basically infinite for these activists who are doing this kind of thing. But, you know, you see them on the news or whatever, and it might look sort of easy, or people might feel like even it sort of looks kind of silly in some ways, but just know that to do that kind of work, you have to draw on a tremendous reserve of courage and spirituality. And I also want to just point out that a lot of activists, especially in other countries outside of the US and indigenous activists, they have paid extremely high prices for this kind of civil disobedience. Many of them have even been murdered. And our action in LA and scientists around the world were doing actions on that same day. And my action certainly was quite a bit. It was extremely low risk relative to what a lot of other people are doing on the front lines, indigenous activists, people of color who because of their socioeconomic status, the color of their skin, where they're located, and the sorts of risks that they're taking, again, have gone just so much further into civil disobedience. It's a deep, deep thing, but it's at the same time, just, I think it's a beautiful practice. And it's just so weird that it's both of those things at the same time, you know, that some of these humans are paying the ultimate price, but that it's still, I don't know, just such a, I guess you could say, such a righteous pathway in some sense.
Yeah, I appreciate you bringing up the discrepancy between, say, what a white scientist would have for consequences versus an indigenous person fighting a huge corporate and military-backed entity elsewhere in the world. It's an important thing.
I just want to add a little bit to that, which is that even in the day after that action, like on April 7th, I received quite a significant amount of pushback just because of the fact that I was a white male. But I don't think that's a reason that anyone should take for not doing these kinds of actions. I think that would just be an excuse. Before an action like that, the brain is looking for any excuse essentially not to do it.
Right.
And I think if you do have the privilege, I think it's, if anything, more important to be willing to take these kinds of risks, if nothing else, just in solidarity with all the other people around the world that are starting to do it.
Right. Well, and it's not like climate is going to be selective in who it affects as it becomes, as you said, more and more hellish. I also, though, don't want to diminish that it is risky for you to have taken that action. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about the aftermath of your arrest. Were there consequences, either positive or negative, that you've had to deal with since then?
So being a white man, I wasn't really afraid of the police and being, for example, brutalized by them. So that's privilege. What I was worried about was potentially losing my job. And I thought that that was a very real possibility. HR at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory really couldn't give me any guidance because no one had ever done anything like that before. So I was kind of taking a leap into the unknown. But I tried to, again, like I said at the beginning of this interview, follow NASA's rules and guidelines over such actions. And it turned out okay in the end. A lot of people within NASA have come up to me privately or reached out to me privately to thank me for doing that. One person in human resources, actually, I was walking to lunch at JPL and she stopped me. She was like, weren't you that scientist who got arrested? And then she thanked me profusely and said that they've been talking about the action within HR. And like, they all agree that it was just a model of how to do that kind of thing correctly. And that they were glad they didn't have to take any actions and it made their life so much easier. So I was really glad she came up to me and told me that because it just made me feel, for many, many years, I've had this weird sort of split between my work life and my activist life. And that's always really bugged me, that I felt like I've been walking on this tightrope. And every time I write an article, I'm taking some big risk and I could get reprimanded. It's been this tension, which I found really kind of holding me back and sort of unpleasant. And so for her to just take that simple action of coming up and telling me what she thought and what they've been discussing really helped me kind of bring those two really important parts of my life, my scientific life and my activist life, more into congruency.
Yeah, I really appreciate that story. And it's a good reminder, I think, to all of us to do what your colleague in HR did, which is to spread the appreciation. And, you know, you never know when something you say is going to affect someone in a really positive way. Like she didn't, maybe didn't even think much of it, but look at how that's affected you. It's really impressive, the kind of ripple effects that we can have by, you know, offering the right encouragement at the right time. I want to go back to, you kind of touched on this a little when you were speaking earlier, but I know you feel the climate crisis as a crisis, as an emergency, and are hoping that others get to that point. We've got to change our behavior, our policy, our business, our governance, our infrastructure. And in trying to get people on board with that sort of idea, you've done the scientific route, changing from being an astrophysicist to being a climate scientist. You've done plenty of peer-reviewed journal articles, plenty of more popular press articles. You tried this more personal route with your book, Being the Change. You've tried social media. As you said, you've tried a nonprofit ad company. You've tried a phone app. Now you've tried civil disobedience. What's your view on how these efforts are building on one another? And what's your thinking on what's next?
That's a great question. Well, I think I've discovered something really deep over the last, that for, probably for most people and maybe most extroverts is like really quite obvious, but for me, it's kind of profound, which is that it's all about people and it's all about relationships. And in the beginning of my journey as an activist, I think I felt kind of remembering everyone's names and getting to know them and just sort of the messiness of activism was just kind of a price that you had to pay to try to make change. And I think now I've kind of come to a very different way of thinking, that it's like these are the people that are my brothers and sisters in arms. And I have this deep appreciation for them and their friendship and their wisdom and their companionship. It feels like now that's kind of one of the main things that keeps me going in my activism and one of the principal joys in my life, really. And I feel like I have just such an honor to have these people now as friends. And it's they're people around the world. And so I think that's kind of where I've come to as an activist. That's the thing that kind of weaves together all of these different efforts at this point. And now I think finally some of the key building blocks that I've been helping to put in place over the last several years are going to start paying dividends. Maybe to use a really bad capitalist analogy, they feel like sort of the hotels on a Boardwalk and Park Place now or something. But I think that I'm hoping that the Climate Ad Project, which is this kind of nonprofit that Harold Moss and I started a couple of years ago, like the first ad agency for the earth, it has really started to become a bedrock part of the civil disobedience movement for things like Extinction Rebellion and Scientist Rebellion. So on April 6th, for example, one of the things that we didn't optimize and that we want to try to do better going forward is sort of the media aspect. You need to have the cameras in the right places, capturing the footage. That has to go to some place sort of centralized where other people have set aside time to edit them and then push them out to journalists and push them out onto social media as quickly as possible and as professionally as possible with like good video quality, good sound quality, good editing, etc. And we didn't have that. It was very just like fly by the seat of our pants on April 6th. And so Climate Ad Project started out as this thing for making funny or heartrending or clever or informative short videos that we were hoping would kind of go viral on social media and that eventually we could get some funding and pivot to putting them on television, et cetera. And now we see it as a much more sort of holistic media enterprise supporting the movement. So that's super cool. And then the app, which is called Earth Hero, which we founded, I don't know, about 3 years ago, that started out from the part of my book that was looking at personal carbon emissions and what one person could do to get involved in the movement and to sort of learn more about these systems, for example, that force us to burn fossil fuels. It's very hard to, I would say impossible, to completely disentangle yourself if you're living, for example, in the United States or pretty much any country of the world, whether it's in the global south or global north. It's very, very hard to fully disentangle yourself from fossil fuel systems, but at least it's very interesting to understand those systems. And I think there is some good that comes from starting to ramp them down, so long as you don't get caught in this obsessive thing where that's your primary way of responding to earth breakdown and climate change, right? You also need to, I think, get involved and speak out and push for systems change and hold politicians and journalists to account, et cetera. And so now, finally, the Earth Hero app is transitioning. I've been pushing it hard for years to start doing what we call community features. And for example, helping new climate activists get in touch with existing organizations so that they can talk to a person in a local, for example, Extinction Rebellion group or Scientist Rebellion group and start getting. So again, like to go back to what I said earlier, I think the way to become a climate activist is to start to become friends, literally, with other climate activists in your area. That's what it's all about. And then that sort of is the beginning of your journey, and you can start to figure out how your particular skills and resources and interests can help the best in the movement, right? But it's all about those person-to-person connections. And so hopefully these sorts of tools are going to increasingly start to help the movement go faster.
Yeah. Well, I think it's really inspiring. And obviously, you have put in an unbelievable amount of effort in your activist journey. And it's a good kind of model for people to look at. I look at it as sort of deeper and deeper layers of engagement that you've demonstrated. And, you know, each time you push it a little further and hopefully open some more eyes. One of the sets of eyes, I guess, that really needs more opening is the eyes that are possessed by our political leaders. We've often joked here in Crazy Town that, at least in the United States, our two main political parties have, you know, they they act out of one of two perspectives, denial and delusion. So obviously the Republican Party tends to champion denial, that there's even a problem with climate or biodiversity or overshoot or anything. And the Democrats are just under the delusion that, oh, we'll just replace fossil fuels with some solar panels and wind turbines, and then it's back to business as usual and continuous growth, infinite economic growth on a finite planet.
One of the ones that gets me the most is California's goal of not selling new gas cars by 2035.
Right.
It's such a great example of too little, too late.
Yeah, no kidding. Well, I'm wondering if you see hope that the movements and protests and activism can wake up our politicians and our broader society from being locked into those two obviously insane perspectives.
I think it's already happening. You know, I think when Jim Hansen got arrested in 2013, it was part of what ended up ending the XL pipeline. And I think, you know, a lot of the activism much more recently in recent weeks and months was instrumental in blocking the dirty deal that Chuck Schumer and Joe Manchin wanted to push through Congress to basically not only greenlight the Mountain Valley Pipeline, but also to make other new fossil fuel projects even easier to permit. I think it's already having an effect. I've long thought that politicians ignore the climate movement at their peril because it has no choice but to get stronger, really. It's being held back right now by the media basically being milquetoast and, you know, not telling the truth in terms of what an emergency this really is and what a dystopian, just hot, crazy, broken down planet we're careening quickly towards, right? And how the fossil fuel industry is literally the cause of that and how they've been lying. Like, I see those dots not being connected. They're hardly ever being connected in mainstream outlets. And that's hugely holding back the climate movement. But on the other hand, because the basic physics means that every ounce of fossil fuels that's burned and converted into carbon dioxide in the atmosphere makes the planet get a little hotter, which makes all of these climate disasters get a little worse every single day on average. So you have a social movement that is being literally driven by physics. And you look at those trends of near surface temperature or ocean heat content, or like how, you know, spring is coming earlier and or how precipitation events are getting worse. Whatever part of the Earth system you look at, sea level rising, ice sheets melting away, glaciers melting away, species going extinct. It's all a trend, right? It's a tilted plot where it should be flat. If we lived on a healthy Earth system, it should be flat. But every single one of these things is a trend. And from an Earth history or geological perspective, these trends are essentially straight lines, straight up into a broken planet. They don't seem fast relative to human lifetime, but relative to ecosystems and Earth's history, they're extraordinarily fast trends. So because of these trends, more and more people are simply going to start waking up because things are getting so broken down on this planet. And the movement can only be held back by media silence and climate change denial and both sidesism and corruption, fossil fuel money corrupting politicians for so long. And eventually it's bound to break through. It's just the sooner that can happen, the more we save of planet Earth and of our collective future, because of the damage, most of the damage that's being done by global heating is effectively irreversible. So that's the way I see it. I think the movement's got to get stronger than the fossil fuel industry. Once that happens, we will see real meaningful, rapid climate action, which means a plan for rapidly ramping down the fossil fuel industry on a global basis. And probably if that happens, it's going to take a lot of buy-in, which means it will necessarily come with protections for poor people, both within the United States and around the world.
Yeah. You mentioned the California car regulation. And I want to turn to that because I think it's entirely relevant to this idea of movement building. I mean, on the one hand, I agree with you, of course. Switching out internal combustion engine cars for electric cars in 2035, it's like let's not use plastic straws, or, you know, it's a very small thing. But at the same time, I think most people looked at that as like some draconian, huge, giant regulation, big government overstepping, and oh my gosh, this is California acting crazy, you know. And I think a lot of people, A, are kind of blind to our energy predicament, and they don't really understand the way society works and how based in fossil fuels it is and how addicted we are to it. And then B, like, change is hard for a lot of people. And they're, like you said, these climate changes are happening on an unprecedented scale and rate. And, but we still have trouble kind of tracking it, you know, with the speed at which we think. So I think there's also a societal problem here, and maybe the movements can help there too. It's not just waking up politicians, it's waking up one another to this notion that, hey, we need to make a change together. And yes, there may be some sacrifice involved in that change, but there's also a chance for a future and maybe some more thoughtful and meaningful pathways of living life than just consumerism and watching YouTube videos all day.
Well, let me be really clear about a couple of things. So one is that, you know, if you think that just ending the sale of new gas cars in California by 2035 is draconian and is too fast, that's climate denial, plain and simple. So it's like if your house is burning down, if for some reason your eyes were not able to see the flames and you weren't able to accept the fact that your house was burning down, or sir, maybe your neighbor's house was burning down, then you would think it was crazy and a waste for the fire trucks to come and start spraying water because you don't even see the fire. But when you can see the fire, you realize that you're in an emergency. And we're in this weird cultural moment, which has been sort of the whole time I've been a climate activist. It hasn't really gone away. But now it feels maybe in some ways weirder because the climate disasters are so much more clear and present and dangerous than they ever have been. So to still have people not recognizing that this is an emergency, and even a small fraction of those people not even accepting that there's any global heating at all, is just tremendously weird to me. But yeah, any policy, any activist action is going to be seen very differently by someone who recognizes the emergency for what it is and someone who is still in denial about how quickly and how seriously things are changing. And then the second thing I want to make really clear is that in my theory of change, you don't get change starting from the politicians because, to just be very plain speaking about it, they're corrupted. They're corrupted by money and politics. They're corrupted by the need to kowtow to the donor class so that they can win their next election. A lot of them come from the ultra-rich class themselves, right? And so they not only do they fail to see the perspective of the poor class, they're actually very much aligned with the needs and the values and the desires of the rich class, right? So we're still in this kind of state of having politicians who, for the most part, are more interested in preserving a fossil fuel industry than they are in preserving a livable planet. So in my opinion, the only way to come out of that, it's all about power, and we need grassroots people power. We literally need a climate movement that's at least as strong as the fossil fuel movement so that politicians are basically more afraid, or maybe you could say more respectful or more cognizant of the climate concerned electorate than they are of the fossil fuel industry donors. Because again, another thing that's completely crazy town is that by far the biggest cause of global heating and all of the climate chaos that increasing global heat is causing is the fossil fuel industry. And yet there's all of these kind of policy ideas and acts and ideas coming out of COP26 that basically dance around the huge elephant in the room, which is the need to rapidly ramp down the fossil fuel industry. They talk about things like methane leaks, because you could fix those without ending the fossil fuel industry. They talk about clean coal. They talk about carbon capture. They're going to start talking about geoengineering more and more. And these are all things that sound maybe to like the uninformed person like a climate quote unquote solution, but they're really just ways to distract and delay the real solution, right, which is ending the fossil fuel industry.
Yeah, I just thought of the metaphor. It's like you've got a bathtub and the water is turned on and it's filled up and the water is starting to overflow onto your bathroom floor. And all the policies to fix it are about, oh, well, let's get a mop. Oh, let's exactly. Let's put a bucket on the floor of the bathroom.
Why don't we take a teaspoon and start taking some of the water out of the bathroom?
Right, or let's make an incentive whereby people don't feel water on their feet when they walk in the bathroom, or so, you know. But it's not turning off the water, right? That's the first and best policy option.
That's why I think the civil disobedience is a really good place for the movement to go deeper and deeper into right now. Because I think one of the main things that it's able to do is to break through this collective denial that we're all in. And I really don't think writing books has really anything close to what I think maybe writing books about the climate emergency in some ways might reinforce that bystander effect. Because it's the kind of thing that people do when there's kind of a quote unquote normal issue, or when the whole planet isn't about to start burning up, right? You write books about things, right? That's kind of the old school. Not that writing books about it is bad. Like, it does help us. Like I said, even for myself personally, writing my book helped my thinking deepen on this topic, but it just doesn't really wake people up the same way, because it's a quote unquote like normal or non-emergency response to what is, from I think an earth scientist perspective, very much an emergency.
Yeah, I want to stick on that and maybe even conclude with thinking about how activists go about dealing with the weight of the emergency, with the crises. I mean, you and I have both been engaged in some degree or another through career, through activism, in trying to deal with climate, trying to deal with biodiversity loss. You got people out there dealing with colonization and social injustice, and everybody goes about it differently. But in observing you and in some of our private conversations, I feel like you're going about it from the perspective of protecting your son's lives. Like, you're feeling this emergency in your bones. I feel like I'm able to deny or compartmentalize maybe a little more than you're able to. And I don't know that that's a good thing or a bad thing, but it's certainly different. And I guess I'm wondering, how are you managing that just feeling of dread? Are you constantly charged up with cortisol and adrenaline and raring to go? Or, you know, how are you dealing with the emotional weight of this?
Yeah, thank you for that question. It's a really deep question. So how do I start answering that? So on a day-to-day basis, I do things that I think are good for my brain and that also that give me joy. So that helps a lot. These are things like meditating or going for a run. Actually, it's weird. When I was younger, I hated running and I did everything I could to avoid it. And now it feels really good while I'm doing it, and I feel really good afterwards. What else? Playing music, something like that's a real balm for my brain. And it's a really just a great way to be with people. Both of my sons are very musical, and so is my wife. And so it's just, we got to get the family band going. I've been working on that for a while, but it's harder than it sounds. And then also, you know, doing the activism, it is very, I think it's very meaningful. I feel called to do it. So it's a dangerous thing if the activism and the attention and talking to journalists and all of that stuff makes your ego bigger. I think that's a path to more suffering in the long term. So really, the closer you can come to the ideal of genuinely being just a mouthpiece for the earth and feeling really like a deep sense of gratitude and humility. And then the meditation practice really helps with that, because it's about dissolving the ego. But, you know, sometimes my meditation practice is really strong, and then other times there's kind of this monthly cycle, you know, other times it's much weaker than I would like it to be. That's very helpful though. And in the long term, I'm very committed to going deeper and deeper into my meditation practice, which is something I've been working with since 2003. I recently moved from California to North Carolina because my partner got a job at Duke University. And I've been just really enjoying this kind of southeastern forest with all the bugs, and actually rains here and the trees are still green. There's lots of oak trees and pines around. Hearing those insects and birds and being out there, maybe running along a creek, it's so nice. It's, you know, compared to being in the smoke cloud and the heat waves in California. But at the same time, I feel such a deep sense of grief about the High Sierra. You mentioned my sons. I also, when I was basically in high school, sort of fell in love with the planet, I think in a real way, when I was building trails in the mountains of New Mexico, up in the Sangre de Cristo Mountains, actually as part of the Boy Scouts. There's a ranch there, they're called Philmont, and I worked there for several summers doing what they call conservation work, which involved building trails with rustic tools, teaching Boy Scouts how to do that, and just really fell in love with those mountains. It was just, they're so beautiful. And when they burn, and when the High Sierra burn, it just kills me. When I walk through the High Sierra on the John Muir Trail there, and I see all the dead trees, which really just the mortality just took off in a crazy way over the last couple of years, it just kills me. And I can't go into those natural places anymore with just a pure sense of childlike wonder and joy, which to me is such a huge loss. Now I'm walking through these beautiful places and seeing mortality and seeing change and seeing biodiversity loss and wondering how bad it's going to get in the future. So it's this complex sense of enjoyment and wonderment, but also grief as I walk through these beautiful places. So it's an evolving thing. I think, like I said earlier, the friendship of the climate activists that I talk to every day and that I work with and that I risk alongside, that is a very significant part of what allows me to keep going, I would say. So it's all of that stuff together. And I don't think I'm done understanding that dynamic within my own psyche of how I relate to this rapidly changing planet and with the trolls who find ever more creative ways of calling me an idiot on Twitter, and the people that write me emails about how much my book has helped them or how they've started doing some of the stuff I've been doing in terms of civil disobedience. So it's very complicated, I would say.
Well, it's interesting. I'm sitting here nodding along and smiling to myself and thinking of all these other things I've seen and stories that I have that go stride for stride with what you're experiencing, and feel kind of the same way. One of the insights for me is, look, you can look at Crazy Town with a share, Jason and me, or me and you in an interview like this, and we can throw around a lot of sarcasm and you know, sort of poke fun, and there's a lot of, you know, humor, maybe even gallows humor, in a community of people that are thinking about these really heavy issues and the fate of humanity and the fate of the planet. But at its core, I think it comes from a place of supreme care and love. Like you said, falling in love with the planet, like going out into a place outside, and it doesn't have to even be, you know, I tromp around on Mount Hood and in the Columbia River Gorge and you know, places in the Pacific Northwest. You talked about the High Sierra. It doesn't have to be places like that. It can even just be a little creek in the backyard. I talked with Taylor Brorby. He was talking about the immensity of the prairie and how it's the width of that grassland that's intimidating. And that really struck me. I mean, so it doesn't have to be some majestic, you know, Yellowstone, Grand Teton mountainscape.
Great point.
It can be anywhere. And it's that love and that connectedness that it's almost hard to describe in words. When you're there and you feel it, you are part of something that you've always been part of. And I think it's that feeling that pushes us to do this, and that maybe it's the key to dealing with the grief and the emotional weight of it all. What's your thinking on that level of connectivity?
That's exactly what I was going to say, is that it's a feeling of profound connection. I think that it's another way to get to that that feeling of ego dissolution. I think all of our suffering is basically caused by our ego. Even when we're feeling like painful physical sensations, it's a sense of attachment to this like corporeal body, which is always changing and vibrating. And we're just here for a few decades in a universe that's existed for billions of years and that will exist for billions of years after us, right? This like strange, strange collection of atoms and subatomic particles that we call Rob or we call Peter. And it's really just, we're all just so much more connected than we are aware of. Like there's this illusion of separation. And to me, being in places of nature, whether it's the little creek or a hill overlooking the town dump, or it's these grander places, or whether it's just feeling like you're part of this grand movement of nature defending itself, which we call right now, we call the climate movement. The key thing there, the thing that makes it all work and the thing that makes it sustainable is not to try to get more and more for yourself, but to instead just try to give as much of it away as you can and to break down that barrier between you and not you, which is kind of where gratitude and love reside, basically. And I know that sounds kind of corny, but I mean, even if you have a fight with your partner, it's exactly the same thing, right? The fight comes with suffering and it comes because you're holding on to something egoically. And if you or your partner can kind of put that fig leaf of a genuine apology or a genuine connection or just reaching out and touching the other person in a genuine way, the fight, I don't know if you felt this, but it doesn't even have to be with your partner, but the fight just kind of dissolves and you feel wonderful, right?
Yeah, I think when we feel validation coming from others in our community, when we feel that connectedness to nature, yeah, that's when we're in our best state of mind to do the work that's in front of us. And
there's something really deep there. I think the rest of the natural world sort of gets that in some you know, unconscious or subconscious way. And I think the human quest to kind of separate from nature and to sort of get as physically as comfortable as possible, which has led to some really wonderful things that I don't want to go back away from, but it's also led to having billionaires and having like way more than we need. And even just things like eating too much, right? Which is a form of suffering. But I think that I suspect that billionaires are probably actually far more miserable than normal people, and they don't even realize it because they have all of like the physical comforts they could ever want, but yet they're kind of further away from being connected to all of that is like not them, essentially.
Right.
And I think that's a kind of suffering, but it's not always legible to people. It's easy to not understand that as suffering, right?
Yeah, well, and I've often talked about the tyranny of comfort and how you can get tied into just seeking comfort, and it's really discomfort that pushes us, allows us to explore. You know, there's nothing really comfortable about walking over a mountain into the next valley, but if you're not willing to go through that, then you're never going to know what's in that next valley. So, yeah, I agree. I think if you're focused entirely on just material pursuits and trying not to be uncomfortable, you're missing out. Well, look, I really appreciate what you're doing, Peter. I feel really connected with you and enjoy following your pursuits. And yeah, just feel like a kindred spirit. And I don't know what your plans are on the rest of the day. I know I'm going to do some of what we've talked about. I'm going out in the woods and do some contemplation and maybe some running around and thinking about next steps and where I can be useful and really going to be thinking about this conversation. I think it's going to help me think about how to ground myself better.
Yeah, that's wonderful. I always enjoy talking to you too. I think I'm on this, what they call the 980 system at JPL. So this is my like every other Friday that I get off. And so I think I'm going to go for a run and then do some some action planning with some of my activist friends and see what kind of good trouble we can get into a little bit later this fall.
Yeah, I like that. Let's all get out there, see what kind of good trouble we can get into. Well, hey, thanks so much for coming on Crazy Town again, Peter, and I'm sure we'll be in touch more soon. So best of luck in all of all the work you're doing.
Thank you, Rob. Yeah, it's still my favorite podcast, so keep them coming out.
All right. Thanks, Peter.
Thanks for listening. We just gave you a whole bunch of do the opposite ideas so you can take action in your life and community. If that's too much at this time in your life, do something real simple. Give us a 5-star rating on Spotify or any other podcast app and hit the share button to let your friends know about Crazy Town.